From PRI, Public Radio International.
In the manger, Mr. Pope had rigged up a reading light, which was small enough so that Mrs. Pope couldn't see it from the house, and the horse read far into the night. He got very clever at turning the pages with his nose, and for the first few months he would hardly stop reading long enough to speak to Mr. Pope except to demand more books. But before long, he had read all the adventure stories and even some of the more serious novels in the house. Mr. Pope wouldn't get him any more magazines with jokes or risque stories in them because twice Ed had got to roaring with laughter in the middle of the night, and Mrs. Pope had sent Mr. Pope out to the barn to see if it was tramps. So then Mr. Pope got Ed a card at the public library. So two or three nights a week, they would ride over to the library and get a couple of books. Of course, Mr. Pope had to go in and pick them out, and Ed didn't always like his selections. "That's all right, Ed," said Mr. Pope, "but you can't read detective and adventure stories all the time. Some of your reading ought to be to improve your mind." "Listen, Wilbur," said Ed, "I'm a horse. What good is an improved mind in a stable?"
That was Tony Roberts reading from a story by Walter R. Brooks. This is Selected Shorts, a celebration of the short story, and I'm Isaiah Sheffer, Artistic Director of Symphony Space on Broadway and 95th Street on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, where Selected Shorts originates. The two tales we'll hear on this program, however, were not read at Symphony Space, but were read as part of Selected Shorts' continually growing touring program. The first one is about a horse who can read, and the second story is about rowing. The first story was read at The Mount, Edith Wharton's lovely house and gardens in the beautiful Berkshire Hills of western Massachusetts. The story is Ed Has His Mind Improved by Walter R. Brooks, and it's part of a volume of stories which were the inspiration for the popular television series about a talking horse, Mr. Ed. In this case, we were celebrating at The Mount the recent purchase by The Mount of Edith Wharton's library, and so we did a weekend of stories about libraries from all conceivable points of view, including the point of view of a horse who wants to get a book out of the library. Now, there is something that you radio listeners may need a little explanation to appreciate. At a certain point, there's a big laugh, and it comes from a visual effect. Tony Roberts reaches the line, "You can't learn anything in a barn." And then he stops and looks around, because the room we're reading in was, in fact, the carriage house and barn of Edith Wharton. And so that's what that laugh is all about. Here is Tony Roberts reading Ed Has His Mind Improved by Walter R. Brooks.
I suppose it's kind of silly of me to keep on telling people about Wilbur Pope's talking horse. People are awful skeptical. "Prove it," they say, "prove it." Well, I can't prove it. Neither can Mr. Pope prove it, because the darn horse won't cooperate. He'll talk all right when he's alone with Mr. Pope, but get him out in company where you want him to show what he can do, and he shuts up like a clam. "I've told everybody you can talk, Ed," said Mr. Pope, "and I do think you might back me up. All our neighbors here around Mount Kisco are beginning to whisper behind their hands when I come into a room, and I've lost two of my best accounts because they say they can't leave their advertising in the hands of a man who chats with animals." "I appeal to your better nature, Ed," he said. But Ed just laughed. "Yeah," he said. "Who told you I had one?" So Mr. Pope had to go around and tell everybody that he had just been kidding, and that Ed couldn't talk at all. But they still act funny to him in Mount Kisco. Well, I don't live in Mount Kisco, and I'm not an advertising man, and so I don't see why I can't tell the truth about things, and particularly about what happened when Ed learned to read, because there's a lesson in it for us. Well, Mr. Pope's house was always overrun on Saturdays and Sundays with a noisy crowd of Mrs. Pope's friends. At least I suppose you'd call them friends, for most of them were young men who were trying to persuade Mrs. Pope to run away from Mr. Pope. And marry them or something. It really wasn't any fun for Mr. Pope. It wasn't good for him either. He was getting a terrible inferiority complex, for all of Mrs. Pope's suitors treated him as if he were a sort of oaf. So he bought this horse, Ed, and spent most of his weekends riding. Ed had things the other way around. To him, Mrs. Pope was the oaf and Mr. Pope the jewel, and he didn't hesitate to say so. He was pretty outspoken, even for a horse. Mr. Pope said, "Oh, tut, tut, and show on. I can't have you saying things about Carlotta, Ed." But he liked it. It built him up. He and Ed ambled over the countryside, stopping at wayside taverns for beer and lolling and arguing about life under roadside trees. Well, one day they were sitting around like this, and Mr. Pope was reading the Sunday paper. And every now and then he would read out an item to Ed, and they'd argue about it. But by and by, Ed said, "I wish you'd lay off this political and business stuff. Haven't you got any good murders?" "Murders don't improve your mind, Ed," said Mr. Pope reprovingly. "Neither do the columnists," said Ed. "I'd like to pick my own news for a change." "Well," said Mr. Pope, "suppose I teach you to read." So after a while, they rode home, and Mr. Pope sneaked into the house the back way and got a bottle and an old primer from the attic and took them out to the barn. The first lesson wasn't very successful from a cultural point of view because the primer was one of those that starts with A stands for aardvark. "What the hell is an aardvark?" said Ed. "Why not teach me words I know, like A stands for ale?" "What's this next letter?" Mr. Pope said it was B. "Oh, that's an easy one," said Ed. "B stands for beer." "And what's this?" "C," said Mr. Pope. "C stands for scotch," said Ed. "No, no, no, Ed," said Mr. Pope. "C stands for, cognac. Well, this didn't make sense to Ed, and Mr. Pope tried to explain, and they got into an argument that lasted until it was so dark that they couldn't see the letters anymore. The bottle was empty, too. Ed was persistent, and he had Mr. Pope nail the primer up over the manger, and in a week he could read, "The cat chases the rat as well as you or I can." Then Mr. Pope brought out an old school reader, and Ed went to work on that. But after he'd got through the third selection, he struck. "This stuff is too darn noble, Wilbur," he said. "I can get all the edification I need out of your conversation. Bring me something a little low." So Mr. Pope got copies of a few of the more ribald magazines, and as a slight corrective to these, he brought out the Three Musketeers. Ed simply ate them up. In the manger, Mr. Pope had rigged up a reading light, which was small enough so that Mrs. Pope couldn't see it from the house, and the horse read far into the night. He got very clever at turning the pages with his nose, and for the first few months he would hardly stop reading long enough to speak to Mr. Pope except to demand more books. But before long he had read all the adventure stories and even some of the more serious novels in the house. Mr. Pope wouldn't get him any more magazines with jokes or risque stories in them because twice Ed had got to roaring with laughter in the middle of the night, and Mrs. Pope had sent Mr. Pope out to the barn to see if it was tramps. So then Mr. Pope got Ed a card at the public library. So two or three nights a week, they would ride over to the library and get a couple of books. Of course, Mr. Pope had to go in and pick them out, and Ed didn't always like his selections. "That's all right, Ed," said Mr. Pope, "but you can't read detective and adventure stories all the time. Some of your reading ought to be to improve your mind." "Listen, Wilbur," said Ed, "I'm a horse." "What good is an improved mind in a stable?" "Get me a good Western to read tonight, will you?" Well, along in the early fall, Mr. Pope had to go to Detroit to present a new radio plan to one of his accounts. He got some library books and some detective story magazines for Ed, and he hired Joe, the handyman, to take care of the horse while he was away. And the first thing Joe did was to find Ed's library and tell Mrs. Pope about it. "Books in the barn?" said Mrs. Pope, and she went out to look them over. "Good heavens, what trash," she said. "Throw those magazines out at once, Joe. And these books seem to be some Mr. Pope got from the library. You'd better take them back." So Joe took them back. Well, Ed stuck it out without literature for 2 days. On the third evening, as soon as it got dark, he slipped his halter, and by cutting across lots and down back roads, reached the library unobserved just before closing time. He peeked in a window. Nobody was there but Miss Sigsby, the librarian. Ed pushed the front door open with his nose and clumped up to the desk. "Excuse me, ma'am," he said. "Have you got anything by Edgar Wallace?" Miss Sigsby gave a kind of faded squeal and went right over backwards. Chair and all. "Sorry I startled you, ma'am," said Ed. "If you got a slug of whiskey handy, it would make you feel better. I just wanted a book." Well, Miss Sigsby was an old-fashioned blue ribbon teetotaler, and Ed's suggestion brought her round quicker than a drink would have. She was up and back in her chair before you could say John Galsworthy. "How dare you," she said. "How dare you leave this library at once?"
"I don't get it, ma'am," said Ed, backing away from her. "I just wanted a book."
"A horse," she said, staring at him, and she shuddered. Then she stiffened again. "Horse or no horse," she said, "you dare to come in here and offer me a drink of liquor?"
"Oh, that," said Ed. "I didn't offer you a drink. I don't use the stuff myself. But skip it. Can I get a book out on Wilbur Pope's card?"
"Mr. Pope," said Miss Sigsby. "You're Mr. Pope's horse. I remember there was some gossip about his pretending he had a talking horse. People thought he was joking. But then it wasn't a joke."
"No, ma'am," said Ed. "Now, about that book."
"Of course we can let you have a book," said Miss Sigsby. "But the books Mr. Pope has been selecting for you, dear me, you won't mind if I select something suitable for you?"
"Well, ma'am," said Ed, "if you got any Edgar Wallace..."
"Let me see," said Miss Sigsby. "How old are you?"
Ed said he was rising 9.
9, said Miss Sigsby, going over to a shelf. "Now, here is just the thing for you. Exciting and at the same time a high moral tone. Have you read any of the Rollo books?"
"Nah," said Ed disgustedly.
"See here, young man," said Miss Sigsby sternly. Then she stopped and said, "Gracious, I can't call you young man, can I? What should it be? Young colt?" "But at 9, you're hardly a colt, are you?"
"No, ma'am,"
said Ed firmly. I'm a grown horse, and I don't want my mind or my morals improved. Now, can I have an Edgar Wallace?
Why, of course, said Miss Sigsby. We can't force you to improve yourself.
And she got an Edgar Wallace, and Ed thanked her and trotted off with it in his mouth. Well, Mr. Pope was in Detroit 10 days, and Ed went over to the library every night, and he and Miss Sigsby got quite friendly. The library was badly in need of funds, and so far all money-raising schemes had failed. Miss Sigsby didn't have much sense about such things, but she did know that a horse that could read would draw a crowd. So she put it up to Ed. Would he give a public reading? Well, it was against Ed's principles to do such a thing, but he couldn't help being flattered. Gosh, ma'am, he said, it's nice of you to ask me, but I really couldn't.
Nonsense, said Miss Sigsby. Of course you could. The library has done a good deal for you, and isn't it rather selfish of you to refuse to do a small thing for the library?
Well, said Ed slowly, now you put it that way, I suppose it is. Well, he said, I'll do it.
The next day, Mr. Pope got home, and he was pretty sore when Ed told him, I suppose you know what it means. Thousands of curiosity seekers tramping over the lawn and eating peanuts and staring at you, and news photographers hiding in the oat bin. Never a moment to yourself anymore.
No cross, no crown, Wilbur. Said Ed. I expect it's the penalty of fame. And don't forget, there'll be Hollywood scouts, too.
I am not forgetting it, said Mr. Pope. But what good would it be if I signed up a Hollywood contract for you? You wouldn't go through with it and let me make some money. You'd just refuse to talk again.
Probably I would, said Ed. But I don't see why I can't have a little fun when it comes my way. And anyway, he said, I promised Miss Sigsby.
Mr. Pope was pretty upset. The good times he and Ed had had together would come to an end once the horse was a celebrity, and Carlotta would be furious at the notoriety. He walked down to the library that night to plead with Miss Sigsby, but it wasn't any good. Anyway, I couldn't stop it now if I wanted to, she said. I've taken the matter up with the trustees. I hadn't anticipated that they would be so skeptical. Frankly, Mr. Pope, my position and even my reputation are at stake. Mrs. Dilway and Dr. Polder are the only trustees in town. Mrs. Dilway has agreed always to double any amount we take in through our little entertainments. Of course, as there is usually a deficit, but as I was saying, I have always considered her and Dr. Polder very good friends of mine, but when I told them, dear me, it was a very stormy session. I insisted, however, and finally they did agree to give me a chance to prove my assertion. We've arranged to meet quite informally tomorrow evening in my garden. Now that you're back, Mr. Pope, you will, of course, come over with Ed. You see my position, I am sure. If he doesn't read for them at this little dress rehearsal, Mr. Pope saw all right. So the next evening, he rode Ed over. Mrs. Dilway was a large, imposing presence. She did not believe that horses could talk, as was manifest in the indignant heave of her massive bosom as she gazed on Ed. The Reverend Dr. Polder didn't believe it either. You see how people really feel toward a talking horse, Ed? Said Mr. Pope as they paused before crossing the lawn toward the three. And here's another thing, he said. When the Hollywood producers begin to bid for you, I'm going to sign up with the highest bidder. I'm going to sign a bill of sale. Think that over.
What? Said Ed. Hey, Wilbur, you can't do that.
You've made your bed, Ed, said Mr. Pope.
Come on.
No, but have a heart, Wilb, Ed protested. I'm in a spot. If I let Miss Sigsby down now, she'll lose her job.
You should have thought of that before, said Mr. Pope, pulling him forward. Good evening, Miss Sigsby. Miss Sigsby got up and presented Ed and Mr. Pope to the trustees. They bowed coldly to Mr. Pope, and Dr. Poulter gave Ed a timid nod. But Mrs. Dilway flipped open a lorgnette and gave the horse her celebrated basilisk once over. Ed fidgeted for a second, and then he threw up his head. You don't need that thing, lady, he said. I'll tell you what I am. I'm a horse. Mrs. Dilway gave a strong shudder. Don't be impudent, she said. Then she turned and caught Dr. Poulter by the wrist. He had been saying, oh, dear me, and wringing his hands. Be quiet, Dr. Poulter, she said. No, said Dr. Poulter, trying to jerk away. This is witchcraft, sorcery. I cannot countenance such an exhibition. My bishop, nonsense, said Mrs. Dilway. It's merely ventriloquism. We shall expose it. So, after a minute, Dr. Poulter calmed down, though he continued to tremble, and Miss Sigsby took a magazine and had Mrs. Dilway open it at random and then held it up for Ed to read, while Mr. Pope sat down next to Mrs. Dilway. Ed glanced at the page and shook his head. No, he said. I can't do it. Why, Ed? Said Miss Sigsby. It's hard on you, ma'am, said Ed. But I got to consider my own future. Come on, Wilbur. Let's get out of here. Mrs. Dilway's lorgnette came up again, and she gave a satisfied smile. You see, Doctor, she said, simply ventriloquism. Naturally, if this Mr. Pope can't see the page, the horse can't read it.
Oh, is that so? Ed burst out. And Miss Sigsby said,
But Mrs. Dilway, the horse really can read. I've heard him. I am sorry to see you persist in this attempt to hoax us, Miss Sigsby, said Mrs. Dilway. The outcome can only be unfortunate for you. As for you, Mr. Pope, it seems to me that you are carrying a silly joke dangerously far.
Well, Ed, said Mr. Pope resignedly, I take back what I said about selling you. You better do your stuff. We're going to get a lot of unpleasant publicity out of this anyway of the goods. Leave it to me, boss, said Ed under his breath. There won't be any public reading, and these goofs won't talk either. Then he said to Miss Sigsby, What do you want me to read? So Miss Sigsby held the page up, and Ed began. The waters of the lake, he read, had changed from lead to silver and from silver to rose.
Good gracious, said Mrs. Dilway. He really is reading. Why, this, Miss Sigsby, I am afraid we owe you an apology. Go on, Ed.
So Ed went on. The first flush of surprise reddened the naked limbs of the slender...
Ed!
interrupted Miss Sigsby, blushing.
It's sunrise, not surprise.
Sorry, said Ed. This is kind of fine print for a horse.
He winked at Mr. Pope and continued.
Well, he read a paragraph or two more, and gradually the outraged expression faded from Mrs. Dilway's face. Then Ed read.
As Gregory stepped out of the canoe, the girl ran to him. He seized her and kicked her passionately on the mouth. Then drew back and booted her in the eyes.
Kissed Ed, said Miss Sigsby, and looked.
Oh, said Ed, and continued. Darling, she cried, if Father finds you here, I have my own ways of knowing about your father, he said.
He will not find me here, for he has found a better thing elsewhere today. The words were obscene, and as she nestled in his embrace,
"Really, Ed," said Mr. Pope, and Miss Sigsby said crossly, "the word is obscure, not obscene."
"I'm sorry," said Ed. "I guess it's the company. I mean, naturally, I'm a little nervous. Gregory," she said. "Now, damn you." "Oh, hey, wait a minute," said Ed, interrupting himself. "I guess that's, how can you?" Mrs. Dilway had got to her feet.
"Come, Dr. Polder, we have had quite enough of this obscene exhibition. Please understand, Miss Sigsby, that from today I withdraw all support from the library."
"Hey, just a minute," said Ed.
He trotted around in front of the departing pair.
"There's something you ought to know, ma'am," he said, "before you pull anything like that. I'm giving a reading tonight down at the Elks Hall. It'll be announced that it's for the benefit of the library. And, of course, you'll have to stick to your agreement and match what we take in."
"You're giving no such disgraceful performance for any library I am connected with," said Mrs. Dilway angrily.
"How are you going to stop it?" asked Ed. And as Mrs. Dilway glared, he said, "Now, ma'am, I don't want to be mean, but we got to raise money. If you want to hand Miss Sigsby a check for double what me and Wilbur estimate tonight's gate at, well, we'll call the reading off."
Well, Mrs. Dilway was practically speechless.
This is extortion," she said.
"Yes, ma'am," said Ed. "Shall we say 1,500?
"No," shouted Mrs. Dilway, but Dr. Polder drew her aside and after a few minutes came back to say that she agreed.
"Oh, dear," said Miss Sigsby when they had gone. "It is wonderful about the money, of course, but I'm afraid my position is gone."
"Pooh," said Ed. "They won't either of them dare say a word about this."
"No," said Mr. Pope. "They can hardly go around complaining that they were insulted by a horse."
"Vulgar, but effective. That's Ed."
"Yeah," said Ed. "And the same thing could be said of Shakespeare."
"Dear me," said Mrs. Sigsby. "I never thought of it that way. But it's true."
"Just the same," said Ed, "that 1,500 smackers will buy a lot of Edgar Wallace." "Oh, wait a minute, lady. I know. But part of it you're going to get Edgar Wallace with, aren't you? If you want to make the world better, you got to stop trying to improve people's minds and start improving their dispositions. Speaking of which, Wilbur, how about a can of beer? Huh? Oh, excuse me, ma'am, for mentioning it."
"Not at all," said Mrs. Sigsby archly. "After all, Shakespeare also drank beer." "I wonder..."
She hesitated, and Ed winked slowly at Mr. Pope.
"After all," he said, "we can't any of us never say anything about this evening in public, can we? So it might as well be a good one, Wilbur. Let's creep over to Horley's and bring back half a case."
That was Tony Roberts reading "Ed Has His Mind Improved" by Walter R. Brooks. You can get information about selected short CDs featuring listeners' best-loved readings and request a free reading list all at our website, selectedshorts.org. You are listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide from PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts, recorded live at Symphony Space in New York City. Symphony Space's season is sponsored by Zabar's, offering the nation a taste of New York. Coffee, gourmet foods, and gift baskets available online at zabars.com. Our second touring tale is Mark Helpern's Palais de Justice, which was read as part of a joint presentation by the Westport Arts Center and the Westport Playhouse in Westport, Connecticut, one of Selected Short's favorite touring venues. This story is not really about rowing, but about aging, the older attorney, and the unspoken but real challenge from the young rival. The story had a particular appeal, I imagine, to the maturer gentleman in our audience. The reader is Keir Dulé.
In a lesser chamber of Suffolk County Courthouse, on a day in early August 1965, the hottest day of the year, a Boston judge slammed down his heavy gavel and its pistol-like report threw the room into disarray. Within a few minutes, everyone had gone. Judge, court reporters, blue-shirted police, and a Portuguese family dressed as if for a wedding to witness the trial of their son. The door was shut. Wood and marble remained at attention in dead silence. For quite a while, the room must have been doing whatever rooms do when they're completely empty. Perhaps air currents were stabilizing, coming to a halt, or spiders were beginning to crawl about up high in the woodwork. The silence was beginning to set when the door opened and the defense attorney re-entered to retrieve some papers. He went to his seat, sat down, and ran his hands over the smooth tabletop. No papers. He glanced at the chairs and then bent to see under the table. No papers. He touched his nose and looked perplexed. "I know I left them here," he said to the empty courtroom. "I thought I left them here. Memory must be going. Oh, well." But his memory was excellent, as it had always been. He enjoyed pretending that in his early 60s he was losing his faculties, and he delighted in the puzzlement of where the papers had gone. The first was an opportunity for graceful abstention and serene neutrality. The second, a problem designed to fill a former prosecutor's mind as he made his way out of the courthouse, passing through a great hall arched like a cathedral and mitered by hot white shafts of grainy light. Years before, when he had had his first trial, one could not see the vault of the roof. It was too high and dark. But then they had put up a string of opaque lighting globes which hung to the paneled arches like risen balloons and lit the curving ceiling. One day, a clerk had been playing a radio so loudly that it echoed through the building. The mayor of Boston appeared unexpectedly and stood in the middle of the marble floor, emptiness and air rising hundreds of feet above him. "Turn that radio off," he screamed. But the clerk could not hear him. Alone on the floor with a silent crowd staring from the perimeter, the mayor turned angrily and scanned halls and galleries, trying to find direction for his rage. But he could not tell where the sound had come, and so pivoted on the smooth stone and filled the chamber with his voice. "I am your mayor. Turn it off. Do you hear me? Damn you to hell. I'm your mayor." The radio was silenced, and all that could be heard was the echo of the mayor's voice. The defense attorney had looked up as if to see its last remnants rising through the rafters of daylight and had seen several birds flushed from hidden nesting places, coursing to and fro near the ceiling, threading through the light rays. No one but the defense attorney saw them, or the clerk, a homely, frightened woman who, when the mayor had long gone, came out and carefully peered over the balcony to see where he had stood. It was then that the defense attorney saw the intricate motif of the roof, past the homely woman, the birds, and the light. Now he went from chamber to chamber and hall to hall, progressing through layers of rising temperature, until he stood on the street in a daze. It was so hot that people moved as if in a baking desert, their expressions as blank and beaten as a Touareg's mask, and with impassive eyes, the stonework radiated heat. A view of Charlestown, mountains and forests of red brick and gray shark-colored warships drawn up row upon row at the Navy Yard danced in bright waves of air like a mirage. Across the harbor, planes made languid approaches to whitened runways. They glided so slowly it looked as if they were hesitant to come down. Despite the heat, there was a little haze even near the sea. A plane's August had grasped New England, and Boston was quiet. Good, thought the defense attorney. There won't be a single soul on the river. I'll have it all to myself, and it'll be as smooth as glass. He had been a great oarsman. Soon it would be half a century of near-silent speed up and down the Charles in thin, light racing shells, always alone. The fewer the people on the river, the better. He often saw wonderful sights along the banks, even after the new roads and bridges had been built. Somehow, pieces of the countryside held out, and the idea of the place stayed much the same, though in form it was a far cry from the hot meadows, dirt roads, and wooden fences that he had gazed upon in his best and fastest years. But just days before, he had seen a mother and her infant son sitting on the weir, looking out at the water and at him as he passed. The child was so beautiful. As the woman held up his head and pointed his puzzled stare out over the river and fields, that the defense attorney had shaken in his boat, having been filled with love for them. Then there were the ducks, who slept standing with their heads tucked under their wings. Over 50 years he had learned to imitate them precisely, and often woke them as he passed, oars dripping quietly and powerfully to speed him by. Invariably they looked up to search for another duck. "Oh, you shouldn't be going out today, Professor," said Pete, who was in charge of the boathouse. "Oh, no one's out. It's too hot." He was a stocky Dubliner with a dialect strong enough to make plants green. When he carried one end of the narrow craft down the sloping dock to the river, he seemed to the defense attorney to resemble the compact engines which push and pull ships in the Panama Canal. Usually the oarsman holding the stern was hardly as graceful or deliberative as Pete, but struggled to avoid getting splinters in his bare feet. Haven't seen one boat of all of today. Pete looked at him, waiting for him to give up and go home. The defense attorney knew that Pete wanted to call the Department of Athletics and have the boathouse closed at 2 so that he could go and tend his garden. Really, not one boat? Oh, you could get heat stroke, you know. I saw it in North Africa during the war. Terrible thing, terrible thing. Like putting salt in a leech. The defense attorney was about to give in when someone else walked up to the logbook and signed so purposefully that Pete changed his strategy, saying to both of them, "Now, if I was you now, I wouldn't stay out long. No, not in this weather." They went, as they did each day, to guest S-40, the best of the old boats. It was the last boat Pat Shea had built for Harvard before he was killed overseas. Though already a full professor in the law school and over draft age, the defense attorney had volunteered and did not see his wife or his children for 3 solid years. When he returned, and those were glorious days when his children were young and suddenly talking and his wife more beautiful than she had ever been, he went down to the boathouse, and there was S-40. Gleaming from disuse. Pat Shea was dead in the Pacific, but his boat was as ready as a thoroughbred in the paddock. For 20 years, the defense attorney had rowed loyally in S-40, preferring it to the new boats of unpronounceably named resins, computer-designed from wind tunnels with riggers lighter than air and self-lubricating ball bearings on the sliding seat. Where S-40 had seasoned into a dark blood color, and the defense attorney knew its every whim. As they carried it from the shadows into the building light, the defense attorney noticed the other sculler. He could not have been much more over 20, but was so large that he made the 2 older men feel diminutive. He was lean, muscled, and thick at the neck and shoulders. His face was pitted beneath a dark tan, and his hair long and tied up on his head in an Iroquois topknot. He looked like a Spartan with hair coiled before battle, and was ugly and savage in his stance. Nevertheless, the defense attorney, fond of his students and of his son, who had just passed that age, smiled as he passed. He received as recompense a sneer of contempt and heard the words, "Old man," spoken with astonishing hatred. "Who the hell is that?" asked the defense attorney of Pete as they set S-40 down on the lake-like water. "Oh, I don't know. Never saw him before. Don't like the looks of him. He brought his own boat, too. One of those new ones. He wants me to help it bring it down. Of course, I'll have to. I'll take me time, and you can get a good start so you'll be alone upriver," said Pete, knowing that informal races were common and that if two boats pulled up even, it nearly always became a contest. He wanted to spare the defense attorney the humiliation of being beaten by the unpleasant young man who had meanwhile disappeared into the darkness of the boathouse. As S-40 pulled out and made slowly for the Anderson Bridge, the young man, whom the defense attorney had already christened the Barbarian, walked down the ramp with his boat across his shoulders. Even from 100 feet out, the defense attorney heard Pete say, "You didn't have to do that. I would have helped you." "No matter," thought the defense attorney. By the time he gets it in the water, places his oars, and fine-tunes all his alloy locks and stretchers, "I'll be at the Elliott Bridge and in open water with a nice distance between us." He had no desire to race, because he knew that although he could not beat a young athlete in a boat half as light as S-40, he would try his best to do so. On such a hot day, racing was out of the question. In fact, he resolved to let the young man pass should he be good enough to catch up, for it was better to be humiliated and alive than dead at the finish line. "He cannot possibly humiliate me anyway," he thought. "A young man in a new style boat will obviously do better than a man three times his age in a wood shell." "But," he thought, "this boat and I know the river. I have a good lead. I can pace myself as I watch him. And what I do not have in strength, I may very well possess in concentration and skill." And so he started at a good pace, sweeping across glass-faced waters and the large swelling of the stream just north of the Anderson Bridge, gauging his speed expertly from the passage of round, turbulent spots where the oars had been, and sensing on the periphery of vision the metered transit of tall ranks of sycamore on the Cambridge side. He was the only man on the river, which was glossy and green with a thick tide of bead-like algae. Always driven to the river by great heat, dogs loped along with the gait of trained horses, splashing up a wave as they ran, free in the shallows. S-40 had taut blue canvas decking and oars of lacquered yellow wood with black and white blades. The riggers were silver-colored, an alloy modification and the only thing modern about the boat. The defense attorney was lean and tanned, with short white hair. His face was kind and quiet, and though small in stature, he was very strong and looked impressive in his starched white rowing shorts. The blue decking shone against the green water as in a filtered photograph of a sailing regatta. It seemed to him that the lonely condition upon the river was a true condition. Though he had had a lot of love in his life, he knew from innumerable losses and separations that one stands alone or not at all. And yet, he had sought the love of a woman and the friendship of men as if he were a dog rasping through the bushes in search of birds or game. Women were for him so lovely and central to all he found important that their absence, as in the war, was the stiffest sentence he could imagine, and he pictured hell as being completely without them, although from experience he knew they must have filled a wing or two to the brim. Often as he rowed, he slackened to think of the grace and beauty of girls and women he had known or loved. He remembered how sometime in the middle 20s, when he was courting his wife, he had passed a great bed of water lilies in the wide bay before Watertown. He grasped one for her as he glided by and put it in the front of the boat. But when he reached the dock, the flower had wilted and died. The next day, he stopped his light craft and pulled deep down on a long, supple stem. Then he tied it to the riggers and rowed back with the lily dangling in the water so that he was able to preserve it, a justly appreciated rare flower. But people did not court anymore. He resumed his pace, even though, without straining, he was as dripping wet as if he had been in a sauna for 5 minutes. Rounding the bend before Elliott Bridge, he saw the young man in his new style boat making excellent speed toward him. He had intended to go beyond the Elliott, Arsenal Street and North Beacon Bridges to the bay, where the lilies still grew, where it was easy to turn, although he could turn in place, and then to come back. All told, it was a course of 6 miles. It would not pay to go fast over that distance in such killing heat. If they were to race, the finish would have to be the last bridge out. By the time he had passed under the Elliott Bridge with 2 more bridges to go, the young man had closed to within a few hundred yards. His resolutions fell away as if they were light November ice, easy to break with oars and prow. Almost automatically, he quickened his pace to that of the young man, who, after a furious initial sprint, had been forced to slow somewhat and retrieve his breath. The defense attorney knew that once he had it, he would again pour on speed in the excessive way youth allowed. And so the defense attorney husbanded his strength, going as fast as his opponent, but with the greatest possible economy. This he achieved by relaxing himself, saying, "Easy, easy. The fight is yet to come. Easy now. Easy." Though the young athlete was 100 yards downriver, the defense attorney could see dark lines of sweat in his knotted hair and could hear heavy breathing. "I'm a fool," he said, "for racing in this heat. It's over 100 degrees. I have nothing to prove. I'll let him pass. And then let him sneer. I don't care. My wisdom is far more powerful than his muscular energy." And yet his limbs automatically kept up the pace, draining him of water, causing him salt to burn his eyes. He simply could not stop. He remembered Kafafi's Waiting for the Barbarians, which he, in a clearly Western way, had originally assumed to be a lament. Upon reading it, he discovered that the poet shared in the confusion. For it was indeed a lament that the barbarians were not still on their way. But for the defense attorney, this was unthinkable, for he dearly loved the West and had never thought that to constitute itself it required the expectation of a golden horde. And he believed that if one man were to remain strong and upholding, if just one man were not to wilt, then the light he saw and loved could never be destroyed, despite the barbarism of the war, of soulless materialism, of self-righteous students who thought to remake this intricate and marvelously fashioned world with one blink of an untutored eye. If a man can be said to grit his teeth over a span of years, then the defense attorney had done just this, knowing that it would both pass and come again, as it had the first war and the second, in which he had learned the great lessons of his life, in which he had been broken and battered repeatedly, only to rise up again. He did not want to concede the minor victory of a river race on a hot day in August, not even that, not even such a small thing as that, to yet another wave of ignorance and violence. He started with rage in remembering the sneer. Contempt meant an attack against perceived weakness. And did not weakness merit compassion? If this barbarian had thought him weak, he was up against the gates of a city he did not know, a stone-built city of towers and citadels. The defense attorney increased the rapidity of his stroke to meet his opponent's ominously growing speed. The young man was gaining, but by very small increments. Were the defense attorney to have kept up his pace, he would have reached the North Beacon Street Bridge first, even if only by a few feet. But 2 things were wrong. First, such a close margin afforded no recourse in the final sprint. Because of the unpredictability of the young man's capacities, the defense attorney was forced to build an early lead, which would as well demoralize his rival. Second, not even halfway to the finish, he was beginning to go under. Already breathing extremely hard, he could feel his heart in his chest as if it were a fist pounding on a door. He was lucky, because he knew the river so well that he had no need of turning to see where he was headed. So precise had the 50 years rendered his navigational sense that he did not even look when he approached bridges and shot through the arches at full speed, always right in the center. However, the young man had to turn for guidance every minute or so to make sure he was not straying from the single course, which would have meant defeat. That he had to turn was another advantage for the defense attorney, for the young man not only broke his rhythm and sometimes lost his stroke or made a weak stroke when doing so, but he was also forced to observe his adversary still in the lead. If the defense attorney saw the leather thong in the young man's hair comb begin to dip and saw the muscles in his back uplift a bit, making a slightly different shadow, he knew he was about to turn. This caused the defense attorney to assume an expression of ease and relaxation, as if he were not really racing, and to make sure that his strokes were deep, perfect, and classically executed. He had been in many contests, both ahead and behind. Though it was a full-blooded race, he realized that he was going no more than half the sustained speed of which he normally was capable. Like a cargo of stone, the heat dragged all movement into viscous slow motion. Time was caught in its own runners and its elements repeated. Two dogs at the riverside were fighting over a dead carp lapping in the green water. He saw them clash at the neck. Later, when he looked back, he saw the same scene again, perhaps because of the blood and the heat and the mist in front of his eyes. The salt-stung world seemed to unpiece in complex dissolution. There was a pattern which the darkness and the immediacy of the race made him unable to decipher. Intensified summer colors drifted one into the other without regard to form, and the laziness was shattered only when a bright white gull sliding down the air passed before his sight in a heartening straight line. Though he felt almost ready to die and thought he might, the defense attorney decided to implement his final strategy. About a mile was left. They were nearing the Arsenal Street Bridge. Here the river's high walls and banks stopped the wind, and the waters were always smooth. With no breeze whatsoever, it was all the hotter. In this quiet stretch, races were won or lost. A completely tranquil surface allowed a burst of energy after the slight rest it provided. Usually a racer determined to begin his build-up just at the bridge. Two boats could not clear the Northern Arch simultaneously. Thus, the rear boat had no hope of passing, and usually resolved upon commencement of its grand effort after the natural delineation of the bridge. Knowing that it could not be passed, the lead boat rested to get the strength before the final stretch. But the defense attorney knew that his position was in great danger. A few hundred yards from the bridge, he was only two or three boat lengths ahead. He could see the young man, listening in red, breathing as if struggling for life. But his deep breathing had not the patina of weakness the defense attorney sensed in his own. He was certain to maintain his lead to the bridge, though, and beyond it for perhaps a quarter of a mile, but he knew that then the superior strength of the younger man would finally put the lighter boat ahead. If it were to be a contest of endurance, steady and tortuousome as it had been, he knew he would not win. But he had an idea. He would try to demoralize the young man. He would begin his sprint even before the Arsenal Street Bridge with the benefit of the smooth water and the lead-in of the arch. What he did was to mark out, in his mind, a closer finish, which he made his goal, knowing that there he would have to stop, a good half mile before the last bridge. But with luck, the shocking lead so far in advance of all expectations would convince the struggling young man to surrender to his own exhaustion. An experienced man would guess the stratagem. A younger man might and might not. If he did, he would maintain an even pace and eventually pass the defense attorney dead in the water a good distance before the finish line. 100 yards before the Arsenal Street Bridge, the defense attorney began his massive strokes. One after another, they were in clear defiance of the heat and his age. He began to increase his lead. When he passed through the dark shadow of the bridge, he was already 5 boat lengths ahead. He heard the echo of his heart from the cool concrete, for it was as hollow as a chamber. Back in the bright light, clubbed by the sun, he went even faster. The young man had to turn every few seconds to guide himself through the arch. When he did so, he lost much time in weak strokes, adjustments to course, and breaking rhythm. But far more important was what he saw ahead. The old man had begun a powerful sprint, as if, up to that point, he had only been warming up. 3/4 of a mile before the finish, the defense attorney was going full blast. From a distance, he looked composed and unruffled, because all his strength was perfectly channeled. Because of this, the young man's stroke shattered in panic. The defense attorney beat toward his secret finish, breathing as though he were a woman lost deep in love. The breaths were loud and desperate, abandoned and raw, as if of birth or a struggle not to die. He was 10 boat lengths ahead and nearing his finish. He had not time to think of what he had endured in his life, of the loss which had battered him and beaten him and reduced him at times to nothing but a shadow of a man. He did not think of the men that he had seen killed in war. Those screams were loud enough to echo in his dreams decades after. He did not think of the strength it had taken to love when not love, to raise faltering children in the world, to see his parents and his friends die and fall away. He did not think of things that he had seen as the century moved on, nor of how he had risen each time to survive in the palace of the world by a good and just fight, by luck, by means he sometimes did not understand. He simply beat the water with his long oars and propelled himself ahead. One more stroke, he said, and another, and another. He was almost at the end. He looked back, and a beautiful sight came to his eyes. The young man was bent over and gliding. His oars no longer moved, but only brushed the top of the water. Then he began to work his port oar and turn around, for he had given up. He vanished through the bridge. The defense attorney was alone on the river in a thickly wooded green stretch full of bent willows. It was so hot that for a moment he forgot exactly who he was or where he was. He rode slowly to the last bridge. There he rested in the cool shadow of a great and peaceful arch. Thank you.
That was Pierre Dulay reading Palais de Justice by Mark Helprin. Now Selected Shorts fans everywhere can be a member of the National Selected Shorts Club. You can chat with other fans on our exclusive message board. You can get Selected Shorts bumper stickers, T-shirts, tote bags, and much more. Join today at selectedshorts.org. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of the Best American Short Stories, edited in 2007 by Stephen King, and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and on the web at bn.com. Additional support is given by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, the Lila Acheson Wallace Theater Fund in the New York Community Trust, the Henry Nias Foundation, the Axe Houghton Foundation, the Arthur Foundation, and members of the Symphony Space Literature Producers Circle. Public funds come from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art, and the New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York, and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.